From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up, our critics review Bohemian Rhapsody, starring Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury, the film tracing the rise of the British rock group Queen. Laze Hallström's new film is The Nutcracker in the Four Realms, a fantasy starring Mackenzie Foy and Keira Knightley. Those and many more movies coming up this week on Film Week.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us as you listen to the real Freddie Mercury performing with Queen Live Aid concert. That's one of the major points in the film Bohemian Rhapsody, which is just out this week. Joining me are our critics Leo Lowenstein, Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic. The biographical drama Bohemian Rhapsody is written by Anthony McCartan, Brian Singer, the director. And in the film, Rami Malek plays Freddie Mercury. It follows the band's meteoric rise to success all the way up to that 1985 Live Aid concert.
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform. So what can they do? Imagine thousands of people doing this in unison.
Huh? What's the lyric?
Leo, what do you think of Bohemian Rhapsody?
Well, you know, I actually really enjoyed it. I bet all of our listeners, or a lot of them right now, are clapping along to We Will Rock You. That was one of the really good scenes of the film. Okay. First of all, much has been said about this film before it's even come out. The fact that Brian Singer, the director, left partway through the project, having completed most of it. The fact that Sacha Baron Cohen at one point was going to play Freddie Mercury. Thankfully, he didn't. Rami Malek is so good as Freddie Mercury. I think he absolutely nails the mannerisms, the essence, the sort of ebullience, and the pain. I thought it was terrifically cast. For people that don't really know Queen, but maybe are familiar with some of the songs, they'll be able to sing along to it. Yes, it is in some ways a contrived and cliched biopic. I have to get that out there before Justin does.
But it almost goes without saying.
In a right.
You have to have scenes that sort of stand for much more.
Yes.
And the audience kind of, it tells you it's phony, but they kind of need it to
move
it along.
That's exactly right, Larry. Whether it's, you know, The Doors or Walk the Line or Ray.
Even Ray, which Ray. Jamie Foxx, but there are these scenes that they're just phony.
Exactly. And, you know, they're a little bit phony, but it's poetic license and, you know, you kind of need them there to move the story along. I thought also did a terrific job of actually the music moving the story along as well.
Yeah, I don't entirely disagree with everything that you said. No, because, you know, as Freddie Mercury, Rami Malek does give a really good performance. I think he carries this movie to the extent to which it can be carried. I just think, though, that, you know, other people have made this joke, but it's like in a post Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story world, I just don't know if this kind of formula works anymore. And from that first moment with they start off at the Live Aid concert, or I think you get this little hint of it, and, you know, it sets the scene, and then it whooshes back to, you know, how did all this happen? I just kind of rolled my eyes. And even though the music is enjoyable, individual scenes are enjoyable. Oh, yes, that's how they came up with We Will Rock You, or oh, yes, that's how he wrote Love of My Life, you know. It just felt very just cursory and broad brushstrokes, and also weirdly airbrushed
to me. But Justin, it's two hours, 2.5
exactly.
hours.
Exactly.
And what, you know, you have a lot to condense
it's
there.
2 hours and 14 minutes,
okay,
I think.
Right.
And I think that it's a trick. This is why I wonder if this formula works anymore, because I do think that the best biopics and better biopics that Anthony McCarten has written, actually, like, say, Darkest Hour, focus their narrative, you know, window to a tighter section
sometimes.
Of the story. Yeah, and they kind of did want to tell the story of Queen, the entire story, I get that,
right.
with heavy emphasis on Freddie Mercury, but I just feel like everything gets short shrift and is reduced to cliches as a result.
I disagree. I don't think that boiling it down to a 2-hour, 14-minute movie really reduced it in terms of its impact. I mean, I think this is a film that sort of spans the chronological events of the creation of Queen. It does give front and center position to Freddie Mercury, as it should. And it's anchored by a terrific performance. I mean, it doesn't, and it earns its emotional moment. There are moments that actually really get you. I have a friend that never cries, and she wept in this one.
There are emotional moments. I mean, he does focus, for example, like on his relationship with Mary Austin, his longtime best friend, who even as he was wrestling with his sexuality, you know, the relationship was so strong, and they, you know, they use Love of My Life as kind of showing that to be have been part of the inspiration. He was singing about her, and they're lovely moments. I mean,
that's Lucy Boynton, by the way, who was so good in singing.
I was reading about that, his relationship with her, and it was really interesting. As a gay man, sort of this prominent role that she plays in his life, and sort of the complexities of sexuality. I mean, there's a real richness there to explore.
That's right. She was, I believe, named in his estate. She was, you know, really sort of the partner that he always had but could never be with physically.
Yes. I think that the movie, and I think the movie tries to get into that and be very sympathetic, but I also think it feels conflicted about Mercury's legacy, who was, you know, who so dominated, and, you know, this was part of the roiling internal tension within the band itself. And, you know, it's, you know, Brian May and Roger Taylor, I believe, are producers on the film. And it, the perspective of it is a little interesting, and I think a little bit judgy in certain moments.
Really? Yeah. I didn't think so. And that's actually been some of the controversy about it before, in advance of it coming out, too, is did it give short shrift to Freddie Mercury being gay? Did it not go far enough into it? Did it not go dark enough? And you know what? I think it's impossible for a film to do all things well. I think it did pretty darn well, and it was fun.
I just think for a movie that is named after a song that was boundary pushing and genre blurring, this movie doesn't deserve that.
Maybe
title.
Not, but it is a Bohemian Rhapsody in its own sense.
Bohemian Rhapsody is the film. It's in wide release, rated PG-13. Bryan Singer directed most of the film. Anthony McCarten is the screenwriter. Rami Malek starring as Freddie Mercury in the film. Also out this week, The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, a Disney fantasy adventure, co-written by Ashley Powell and Tom McCarthy, and co-directed by Lasse Hallström and Joe Johnston. It stars Mackenzie Foy, Keira Knightley, Helen Mirren, and Morgan Freeman. What a cast. Film about Foy's character, a young girl named Clara, transported into a magical world of gingerbread soldiers and an army of mice.
Merry Christmas, Clara.
Godfather.
Your gift this year will be something you'll never forget. Most people don't realize there are troubled realms within our world.
The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, Justin.
I think we're going to have a little bit more consensus on this one. this should be called Nutcracker and the Four Quadrants. This is your latest Disneyfied desecration of a family-friendly holiday classic. Trying to seize on this, you know, the beloved story by E.T.A. Hoffman and the famous Tchaikovsky ballet that was adapted from it, and turning it into this glistening, Christmassy, twinkly, family-friendly fusion of the Narnia stories and Alice in Wonderland. It's not entirely without its charms. I think my favorite thing about the movie is the opening shot. This is this kind of Robert Zemeckis-y tracking shot of Victorian-era London on Christmas Eve. So it sets the scene. Mackenzie Foy plays the young Clara, who, along with her family, is grieving the recent death of her mother, and therefore not in a very festive mood. Until her toy-making godfather, Drosselmeyer, played by Morgan Freeman with an eye patch, why not? Opens a portal into another world where she has to go, and she has to find the key to this Fabergé egg that her mother left her as a present. And there she meets the various residents and leaders of the realms, played by Richard E. Grant, Eugenio Derbez, and as the Sugar Plum Fairy. And
Keira Knightley
doing this, is it Betty Boopish kind of voice?
It's a horrible helium sucking voice. It's dreadful.
It's pretty dreadful. And the Nutcracker himself, played by Jaden Fora Knight. It's a jumble. This movie, also interestingly, we just talked about Bohemian Rhapsody, which had kind of two directors. This one actually has two credited directors, and one of them is Lasse Hallström, and the other is Joe Johnston. So it's this mashup of sentiment and action that does not work.
Oh my gosh, no.
But presumably the reason they teamed them was to get the advantages of each, right?
That is true. I think, yeah, the idea that Hallström would do the kind of sentimental, you know, family scenes, and that Johnston would handle the toy soldiers and such.
Yeah, but that, it's like putting like peanut butter and mayonnaise together. It doesn't work at all. And I love certain Lasse Hallström movies, My Life as a Dog, Chocolat, among others. And you know, Joe Johnston certainly has made his contribution. But to me, this was not only a jumble; it was a travesty. There have been many, many adaptations of The Nutcracker, and there was one, I believe, gosh, maybe like 20 years ago, there was an IMAX version that I remember seeing, and it wasn't too bad. But of course, you know, at its best, The Nutcracker is a ballet. It's been done, you know, for years and years. My mother was actually a musician. She was in the San Francisco Ballet. She played it over 2,000 times. Over 2,000 times.
Yeah, it's a holiday staple.
Yeah, it's a holiday
stage,
classic.
All over the country.
And it did not need to be cheapened and desecrated, you know, the way it was. I thought the CGI even looked crappy, frankly.
Yeah, it did. And this is kind of what Disney, I think, does now with things like Alice in Wonderland. It just piles on all this unnecessary narrative complication.
Yeah.
All right, The Nutcracker in the Four Realms, directed by Lasse Hallström and Joe Johnston, rated PG in wide release. Next up, Boy Erased, a biographical drama based on a memoir written by Gerard Conley. Lucas Hedges, Nicole Kidman, Russell Crowe, and Joe Edgerton star. Edgerton also wrote and directed the screenplay. Tells the story of Jared, the son of a Baptist pastor in a small American town, who's outed to his parents at age 19, has to choose between conversion therapy or exile from his family.
I love you, but we cannot see a way that you can live under this roof if you're going to fundamentally go against the grain of our beliefs. Jared, tell me the truth. That's all.
I think about men. I don't know why. And I'm so sorry.
Boy Erased, again written and directed by Joel Edgerton, Lucas Hedges, Nicole Kidman, Russell Crowe, and Edgerton star. Lael?
Yeah, this is it's a pretty good movie. I wish it was a better one. But, you know, first let me just say Lucas Hedges is really coming into his prime as an actor. I mean, he's so good in this, and has been in a number of films, Lady Bird, Manchester by the Sea. And here he just really is he is the heart and soul of this picture. You've also got Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe as his parents, almost unrecognizable, actually. And to me, the topic, what it was about, was almost more important than the way the film went about presenting it. Like the fact that conversion therapy is still legal in more than half of the U.S. states. I mean, that's alarming and shocking. And it does sort of take you through the process of what conversion therapy is about. And, you know, and it's not unsympathetic to those whose beliefs are so strong in this.
One of whom, the leader of the group, which is called Love and Action, is played by Edgerton
himself. Yes,
you know, and doing a very good job. He's a terrific actor and quite a good filmmaker, I think. You know, and he directed The Gift, which very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with Lael. I liked this movie enough that I wanted it to be better, and I think Hedges is better than the movie and subtler than the movie,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is trying to show a restrained portrait of a campaign, an ideological campaign that doesn't really have much use for subtlety and nuance in itself. The process is compelling to watch the cultish, mm-hmm. the brainwashing, the abuses that are heaped on these mostly young men like Lucas Hedges' character, but also young women as well. But I think that it sort of externalizes the whole process for me. Like, I almost would have wanted to know more about the Hedges character, what he's going through. I mean, the performance is very good at signaling that, but it almost just seems to be showing, like, yes, this is horrible. Yes, this is horrible. It's this litany, this catalog of terrible things, and you do feel a little bit bludgeoned by the
end. I didn't feel it was as heavy-handed as you seem to be saying it was. It just didn't. I just felt like it could have been maybe just a little more defined and a little sharper, but I thought it was still pretty good.
Yeah. Boy Erased is the film. It's at the Arclight Hollywood, the Landmark West L.A., written and directed by Joel Edgerton, and it's adapted from Gerard Conley's memoir, Boy Erased. John Horn on the frame interviewed both Edgerton and Conley. You can find their conversation about Boy Erased by visiting kpecc.org/theframe. We also link to it on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. Coming up, we'll hear about the South Korean mystery Burning. We have many other films, including Orson Welles's The Other Side of the Wind, starring John Huston. It's a satire of Hollywood, a film that was unfinished. We'll talk about what's done to make it on your screen coming up in a minute. I sure hope to see you at the theater at Ace Hotel. Coming up Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, we're just about a month away from our next Film Week screening series, and we're going to see that Oscar-winning film, The Artist, on the big screen at the Ace. It's going to be a wonderful afternoon. It's a 1 o'clock matinee. I'll be introducing the film. We'll watch it together on the big screen at the Ace. And then afterwards, we'll have a post-film conversation that will include Leah Lowenstein, who'll be there on stage, along with Wade Major. We look forward to that. Get your tickets now, kpecc.org/in-person, Sunday afternoon, December 2nd. The Artist, our next Film Week screening, theater at Ace Hotel, downtown LA. And by the way, the Ace is just a couple blocks down from the Tower Theater, where the interior scenes of The Artist were actually filmed. So we'll be in The Artist's own neighborhood. We continue on Film Week with Justin Chang and Leah Lowenstein. Next up, we talk about the South Korean mystery Burning. The film is written and directed by Lee Chang-dong and stars Yoo Ah In. Justin, what'd you think?
I think this is the best movie I've seen this year, and the most absorbing, and also in some ways the most mysterious and elusive and complex. This is a film by the South Korean director Lee Chang-dong, who has made great films like Secret Sunshine and Poetry. And this one is adapted from a Haruki Murakami short story from 1983 that he has adapted to contemporary South Korea. And I almost don't want to spend too much time on the plot because, first off, the movie is 2.5 hours and unfolds quite slowly. Suffice to say, it's a psychological and sort of a romantic triangle. Mm. Three young people. Yoo Ah In plays the protagonist, whose name is Jong-soo. And the other, the woman is played by Jeon Jong-seo. She's an old friend of his that he reunites with and falls in love with. And then there's this other man that she brings into the picture, who's played by Steven Yeun, very well known from The Walking Dead fame, and he gives a fantastic performance. All three of these performances are just brilliant to me. And what's so interesting is that as the director plays out their interactions and follows them, it's the story of class envy, because Jong-soo is a poor guy who lives on a farm near the North Korean border. The Steven Yeun character, Ben, is this rich, privileged, but it's not. It's subtle. It's so subtle. A lot of this movie is almost subliminal. It feels like it's as it's playing out, and it's just completely absorbing. And then halfway through, something happens. Mm. Someone disappears. A mystery sort of asserts itself, and it becomes this search, not just for a missing person, but I know I'm kind of in earnest here, but almost like the meaning of life. So there are a lot of big themes in this movie. I really encourage everyone to see it. This is Korea's submission for the Foreign Language Film Academy Award as well, and I think it's just enthralling.
So, and just to repeat, headline, yeah. Your favorite film of the year. We have 2 months left in the
year.
We
do have 2 months. I absolutely keep an open mind. Something could dislodge it, I'm sure.
Yeah, but this is going to be tough to push out. Tough. That's very clear. Leah, what do you think?
Well, a lot of critics agree with Justin, and I liked it. It took me a little bit of a while. Justin and I were talking about the fact that sometimes when you see a movie, the full impact of it doesn't hit you until you've sort of thought about it for a little while. And actually, when I first saw the film, I wasn't as crazy about it. But this film is, well, it's kind of a slow burn in a way, and it takes quite a long time to build up. And it's really not until sort of almost you are looking back on it that you see the complexity and the artistry of how it was assembled. It is, like you said, there's a romantic triangle, there's a mystery. It's an incredibly lyrical and visually poetic film to watch, and you really can't expect it to move fast at all. That's one thing for sure. If you're looking for something faster paced, you will be frustrated. But it is very arresting and quite unique. I don't think there's anyone out there doing what Lee Chang-dong is doing.
Also, you've sort of emphasized the character aspect of it in the story. Justin, what about the visuals? Is it?
I think it's breathtaking visually, which is not something I've always thought about. I love Lee Chang-dong's movies, but this is the first film he's made in 8 years since Poetry. Mm-hmm. His films have always been, you know, quite very, very well made, but there are passages in this that are just visually stunning. Like there's this scene where the character played by Jeon Jong-seo, the woman, is dancing, and she's this piercingly lost, broken soul who feels incredibly deeply, and she just dances at this sunset that is just one of the most beautiful things I've seen this year. So, and it's not entirely like that, but the way he shoots spaces too, he shows you like this cramped, ugly farmhouse where one character lives, and these beautiful, elegant apartments. And there's also a political subtext too, which people who know more about Korea than I do can pick apart. But it's, you know, because one of them lives close to North Korea, and you hear like the propaganda blasts coming over from the loudspeaker. So it's kind of this. You could almost see the movie as this parable for reunification, which is a very relevant thing at the moment. There's a lot to think about in this movie.
So. I just love seeing your face, Justin, as you were describing her dancing at the sunset, because, you know, here you are, a critic. You see, you know, how many hundreds of movies, and to see how great art can affect you, it's great.
I appreciate that, Larry.
You forgot to mention that she's topless, Justin, in that scene.
She's shot in silhouette, too.
But anyway, no, that's beside the point.
I'm sure that had nothing to do with it.
No, I'm just kidding. There are a number of images that are absolutely just kind of seared in your brain from this film. I think it's his most visually evolved film that he's done so far.
Burning is the film from Lee Chang-dong. Written and directed the film, Yoo Ah-ing stars. The film is at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, at the ArcLight in Hollywood, and it's unrated. On Film Week, we also have Orson Welles' movie, The Other Side of the Wind, which Welles was working on late in his life for so many years. It's a satire of Hollywood starring John Huston, Peter Bogdanovich, the director, of course, and longtime friend of Welles, Susan Strasberg, and Oya Kodar, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Welles, his companion late in life. Justin, what'd you think?
I think this is a fascinating, stunning, sometimes tedious, but pretty thrilling just object to behold. I mean, it is not every week on Film Week we have a new picture by Orson Welles to discuss, although this is a very old picture as well. This is a film that he shot from 1970 to 1976, and then was buried for the next like four decades in various circles of legal and financial and political hell, at one point involving the Shah of Iran, who footage was, it's a long story.
And did it ever get edited at that point?
Well, there was, you know, Welles had set a very interesting, you know, editorial rhythm. The movie is so jagged. It is the complete opposite of what you think from the director of, if you know, mainly from Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons. And Touch
He's
of
beautifully
Evil.
Crafted.
Beautiful, black and white, you know, deep focus tracking shots. Here, by contrast, the focus is generally pretty shallow, and it's just cut, cut, cut. And the thing, the interesting about this movie, because it's a mock documentary in which John Huston, the great John Huston, plays this, you know, sort of washed up, reclusive, cranky Hollywood director who is sort of, in some ways, yes and no, a stand-in for Welles himself, who cannot get a film finished. And so there's elements of like 8.5. The movie is sort of a very much a meta-commentary on it. This whole movie is like, you watch this, you feel stranded in this hall of mirrors. And so, yeah, he did edit a lot, but a lot of this was, you know, Bob Murawski, the very veteran editor, took over the task, and Netflix funded this film, the salvage effort. I mean, you know, the task of finally piecing it back together and releasing it, which nobody had thought was going to be possible. Mm. And so it's a little weird to be watching this Netflix, which is unlike any movie that Netflix has released, you know, the new Orson Welles movie beaming at you from your streaming queue. It is playing at one theater in North Hollywood, I believe. And I do encourage everyone to go out and see it or to stream it on Netflix, because it has so much to say about, you know, the new Hollywood of the time. You know, Peter Bogdanovich plays a major role, and there's you know, these roles played by Dennis Hopper and Henry Jaglom, all these personalities, Mercedes McCambridge.
Rich Little.
Friends of Orson Welles.
Susan Strasberg plays this critic who is his dueling partner. She's very much modeled on Pauline Kael. Mm. So it's a fascinating window just into the time. And it plays right now, you know, it actually still feels very prescient in its style as a sort of a mock doc thing. We've seen more of this sort of found footage assembly in recent years. But it's funny. It just again shows how out ahead of his time Orson Welles was. Mm-hmm.
The Other Side of the Wind at Lemley's NoHo Theater in North Hollywood, also streaming on Netflix. It's rated R. They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, a documentary about Welles' making of The Other Side of the Wind. So you can see these as companion pieces. Morgan Neville, the terrific documentarian, is the director of this. And, Lael, you saw this.
That's right. Larry and Neville, of course, did 20 Feet from Stardom, as well as the Mr. Rogers doc, Won't You Be My Neighbor. He's a very gifted filmmaker. I really thought They'll Love Me When I'm Dead was an excellent kind of almost reconsideration of Orson Welles, particularly tying in with the re-release now of The Other Side of the Wind. And Netflix, it's so nice. They're doing the 1-2 punch of, you know, so you can see the film itself and then the doc about the making of the film.
So you'd recommend seeing the film first, then the doc?
What do you
think? It's weird. I almost think it's like watch the movie, watch the doc, watch the movie again. And watch the doc again.
You could see the doc. You don't even need to see the movie because there's clips of the movie.
You should see the movie.
Well, you should definitely see the doc in any case. And to me, because even though I've studied Orson Welles and, you know, obviously Citizen Kane is, you know, still ranked, I think, as perhaps by...
It's number two now by the Sight and Sound Vertigo.
Oh, interesting.
That's tough to choose. For a long time,
Citizen Kane was universely regarded as, like, pretty much the greatest film of all time. And, you know, it's also been really, I think, mistakenly conflated with the kind of reality of Welles himself, because he grew into this oversized man who died before he needed to. He was still a very talented artist, but he became misunderstood by the industry.
Well, and so difficult to deal with.
So, yes, difficult to deal with, but also he was really one of the first mavericks and wanted creative control at a time when the studio system was not going to give it to him.
Absolutely, and said that Citizen Kane kind of ruined him, because how do you follow that?
Yes.
And
that
was,
but he did with Ambersons,
which is extraordinary.
He did, but it was also...
movie, which was butchered.
And taken away from him while he went to South America. I mean, but in any case, I think They'll Love Me When I'm Dead was absolutely fascinating. If you're interested in learning about Orson Welles, who was truly one of the great auteurs of our time, and there are wonderful little interviews, he comes off as much more empathetic, much more of a sort of a softer, kinder person than I had actually imagined. And it was sort of nice to see him in a different light. I thought it was excellent.
The Love Me When I'm Dead documentary on Orson Welles and The Other Side of the Wind from Morgan Neville. You can also see it streaming on Netflix, as Lael just mentioned. So both The Other Side of the Wind and the documentary about it, The Love Me When I'm Dead. And the doc is playing at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Let's at least get started on Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, The Untold Story of the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, a documentary from Dana Adam Shapiro. Lael?
Right. Well, many of our listeners might be sort of raising an eyebrow about this movie, the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders doc. You know, what do we have to say about it that could possibly redeem it?
They had their own reality TV show.
Right. But this was an excellent documentary that also kind of put the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders in a new light and a new context for me. I had forgotten what a huge deal they were. They came into the scene really in the mid-1970s. They revolutionized what cheerleaders were. And this is a portrait of Suzanne Mitchell, who was the den mother of these cheerleaders for a good 15 years. And it sort of posits that they were, in a way, kind of their own sort of feminist take on what was going on. And there's There's a lot to be said about it. It's actually quite a good film.
So a thought-provoking documentary Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders.
That's right.
All right. Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, directed by Dana Adams Shapiro. It's unrated at Lemley's Glendale Theater. Coming up, we'll hear about the Frederick Wiseman documentary, Monrovia, Indiana. First time he's done a documentary in America's Midwest. Back right after this.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind, the story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, now streaming only on Netflix.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Joined by critics Leah Lowenstein and Justin Chang. Documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman made his first film back in 1967. It was Titicut Follies, and he went inside the Massachusetts Correctional Institution Bridgewater to show what life was like there behind bars. It's critically acclaimed documentary. So here we are all these decades later. Frederick Wiseman has made 40-some films in his career, his latest of which is Monrovia, Indiana. And he said, with all the documentaries that he's done, he thought it was fine. It was time to tell the story of Midwestern Americans. And that's what he does in his new film, Monrovia, Indiana. Justin, what'd you think?
Well, Monrovia, Indiana is a farming town with a population of like 1,063, and Frederick Wiseman, in his usual calm, observational, but not detached mode. I think some people think of him as detached, and he's not. It's just he shows you so much and tells you so much, but you put it together yourself in your head, and the rhythms and the images that he shows you tell a story that is so much subtler than a lot of documentaries or fiction films, for that matter, give you. And so in this small farming town, he will show you fields and blue skies and like a liquor store or a church. He'll show you pig farmers going about their work or a church leader speaking to his congregation. And, you know, in typical Wiseman fashion, there are a lot of scenes of meetings, which is just, you know, I love meeting scenes. You could just watch them for hours.
In fact, that's
talking.
What I think of
I
Wiseman. I think of people sitting in meetings
talking
about stuff.
Meetings, in this case, a council meeting of people who are talking about housing issues and talking about the allocation of fire hydrants. And, you know, you see this meeting of a local Freemasons chapter. I don't think that the movie is – I didn't love this movie as much as, say, Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, which came out last year, which I think was one of his best and was a real kind of career summation almost. But this movie, I mean, as you said, Larry, the shift in just in milieu from away from kind of an urban institutional setting is something very new, and it is fascinating to see his gaze fall upon these – the residents of Monrovia. And, you know, it's worth noting, this is, you know, a town overwhelmingly Republican, the kind of place where you expect, like, New York Times journalists to come and write these sympathetic profiles of how the white working class is living. We saw a lot of this in the wake of the 2016 election. What's interesting is that Wiseman doesn't make motivations transparent. He doesn't really clarify this is what you should think, this is what you should take away. The politics are there, but they are buried beneath the surface. He doesn't ignore them. He doesn't prioritize them. They're there. The political exists, but the movie suggests that our politics are only part of who we are.
And he said that was very intentional with the comments that I heard him say about that he didn't want this town to sort of stand for all of middle America and what their political views are. So it's very much in keeping, again, with the kinds of work that he's done in a 50-plus year career of making documentaries. It's extraordinary. 47 films in his career, and it doesn't look like he's slowing down. find out. Monrovia, Indiana, from Frederick Wiseman, is unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. In Search of Greatness, a documentary from Gabe Polsky. This involves a number of different conversations exploring a number of different issues and philosophies. Leo, what'd you think?
I actually thought this was a really enjoyable, very energetic documentary that sort of it's a bit like if you were to sort of take a Malcolm Gladwell book and kind of look at a bunch of different athletes and people who are at the top of their field and sort of see, you know, what do they fit the formula? For example, it takes Wayne Gretzky, Pelé, wide receiver Jerry Rice. And if you sort of put the theory out there that, like, you know, you have to have a certain number of qualifications to become the top of your field, well, these athletes, in conversations with them, they sort of shoot down the conventional wisdom. They say, look, I wasn't necessarily the tallest or the fastest or the most coordinated. So what was it? And that's what the movie is really about. It sort of asks the question, what is it that makes you great? And it also applies that same argument to artists as well as other kind of creative people. And what it sort of boils down to is that something a little bit ineffable in a way. It's ability, but it's also this sort of like drive, yearning, and what Gladwell himself has talked about is that, you know, the need for mastery, the 10,000 hours that you have to put in to get to the top of your field.
Gretzky is such a great example of
he
that.
He is, but he's surprisingly humble in this film, and he also, wow, something I didn't know about him is that he has a photographic memory of every goal he ever scored, every play he ever made. He can remember it in his mind, and he talks about that, and it's absolutely dazzling. He also talks about the fact that he had two younger brothers who had the same training, the same upbringing as he did from his father, you know, who was coaching them, but didn't, you know, they didn't have it. They didn't turn out the same way. They played hockey, but Gretzky became the great one.
I didn't realize he had that sort of photographic goal memory.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, LeBron James also has a remarkable memory about, you know, all his plays. And so you wonder what that is about, the mastery of
sport. There's the whole mental aspect. And then Jerry Rice in this film talks about how before a football game, he could visualize every single play in his head and he could anticipate it. And then when the game came along, he would play it out just as it was in his head, in his dream. Yes, all that visualization.
Matt D'Angelantoni, our Film Week producer, said the Rams head coach Sean McVay reportedly has that same kind of photographic memory, can recall specific plays, downtime. Now, of course, he's barely out of his boyhood. He's so young, so he doesn't have as much to remember. We'll see if when he's 80 years old, he still has that memory. But
that's right.
But you recommend the film?
I do very much. I thought it was an excellent documentary, and there's something in there for everyone.
In Search of Greatness, rated PG-13, Gabe Polsky, the director. It's at AMC's Century City and the ArcLight Sherman Oaks. The comedic drama Bodied is directed and co-written by Joseph Kahn, Calum Worthy, Jackie Long, and Rory Uphold. Star Justin?
Yeah, Joseph Kahn is a Korean-American filmmaker and music video director and a social media personality. This is his third feature, and it shows a lot of skill and a lot of intelligence. It's very entertaining. It's set in the Bay Area battle rap scene, and the movie itself features quite a few real-life masters of the form in the cast. But the movie itself is about a Berkeley grad student played by Calum Worthy, who's writing his master's thesis on this phenomenon. And so he's sort of the white outsider protagonist who enters this, you know, predominantly black underground subculture, although there are other people of color represented as well. And lo and behold, he not only has an academic interest, but he has a real knack for it as well himself. And so he becomes this, you know, his own kind of rap persona, and he rises through the ranks. It might seem tiresome at first, the kind of outsider, you know, narrative, but it really works in this case, I think, because this becomes a movie about the nuances of what you can and cannot say. Because in battle rap, you can pretty much say anything. It encourages, you know, true freedom of speech, I suppose you could say. You can use racist stereotypes. Mm. You can use homophobic epithets. You can be absolutely outrageous. It encourages it. But the upshot of the movie is that the main character learns that these words, fun as they are to throw around, do have consequences. The sheer just verbal virtuosity of the movie is enough to make it worth watching, but it's also extremely thoughtful about cultural nuance and about the assumptions that we sometimes bring into situations and conversations with people who are not like us.
And you're saying this just the second film for Kahn?
I think it's the third.
Third film. All right. Yeah. Bodied is the film comedic drama Joseph Kahn directed. He co-wrote it with Alex Larson, and the movie is rated R. It's at the AMC Burbank. A Private World biographical drama that stars Rosamund Pike, Jamie Dornan, and Stanley Tucci. Matthew Heineman, the director, and Arash Amel is the screenwriter of the film. Lael?
Yes, A Private War with Rosamund Pike as the journalist Marie Brenner, who was one of the most fiercely dedicated and kind of aggressive pursuing in terms of pursuing a story. She lost her eye in Sri Lanka. She had her own demons. It's a good performance by Pike. I thought the movie was deeply flawed, mostly because it does the thing that she says in the film that she's most afraid of will happen to her stories, that they won't be remembered for the essence of them, what she wrote about. The film sort of far too much concentrates on her sort of mental illness and issues with addiction.
A Private Wars, rated R, starring Rosamund Pike at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. More movies to talk about, as well as the announced end of the L.A. Film Festival. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope to see you Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, for the artist Oscar-winning Best Picture, silent film, and it's going to be a blast to see that on the big screen. Bring your family. It's a matinee. 1 o'clock the afternoon, Sunday, December 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Our last film sold out. Want to make sure you get a chance to get your tickets before they're gone this time. Our next film is one that was actually made back in 2015. It's finally getting a release 3 years later. The Grief of Others is written and directed by Patrick Wang. It stars Wendy Moniz, Trevor St. John, and Una Lawrence. Justin, what'd you think of The Grief of Others?
I think Patrick Wang is one of the most interesting and overlooked American independent filmmakers working together today. He came out with a brilliant debut feature called In the Family a few years ago, and he actually has another movie in theaters right now, which opened last week, called A Bread Factory, which is a four-hour, two-part movie that is wonderful.
Oh, yes, we talked about that. Yes,
on the show last
week.
And this one, I think that probably occasions the release of this, the very belated release of this 2015 film, The Grief of Others, which is a beautiful and elliptical, very strange but powerful drama about a family coping with tragedy. It's about a husband and wife living in a small town in New York. They have a 13-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter. And we learn that they've just had a baby who was born with a rare medical condition and died just a few days after being born. Meanwhile, the husband has a teenage daughter from a previous relationship who is pregnant and so living with them. So it's a complicated situation, but one that Wang approaches with a lot of restraint. It's a quiet, delicate film. It seems muted at first, but there are a lot of very strong and realistic emotions that are buried beneath the surface in it. The way that it floats between the characters and the way it introduces these strange, dreamlike flashbacks, my interpretation when I was sawing it was that we are seeing these interactions unfold through the perspective of the dead child, which is a morbid idea, but it actually gives the movie a very poetic and very compassionate feel that's quite heartbreaking.
Didn't the Lovely Bones sort of take that approach?
Yes, this is like the lovely, poetic, art house, good version of the Lovely Bones.
All right. The Grief of Others, being released 3 years after it was completed. The film from writer-director Patrick Wang, starring Wendy Moniz, Trevor St. John. It's unrated at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. The Front Runner, biographical drama, which follows the rise and fall of Senator Gary Hart, stars Hugh Jackman, Vera Farmiga, J.K. Simmons. Jason Reitman is the director. Matt Bai, Jay Carson, and Reitman are the screenwriters. Justin?
This movie starts off with something to the effect of saying, you know, a lot can happen in 3 weeks, and it basically compresses its action into those 3 weeks when the very handsome and charismatic Senator Gary Hart, who was widely expected to clinch the Democratic nomination and the presidency, was derailed by scandal. You know, reporters for the Miami Herald were tipped off that Hart was having an extramarital affair with a woman from Miami, and they followed him to his house. They followed her to his house. Sorry.
Didn't he invite them to follow him,
yes,
though?
Didn't he did.
As well, not part of the story. And I believe he actually said that to a reporter from the New York Times, but here, for ease of narrative flow, they've made it the Washington Post.
Ah.
Kind of like what happened in the Post, right? I don't know. It's funny. There's a reporter played by Mahmoudou Atti who is having this conversation. He almost like says, follow me, you know, and to show that his behavior was above reproach. And some reporters from the Herald did. You know, it's hard to watch this movie and not think of then candidate Trump and the Access Hollywood tape, and which, of course, did not stop him from getting elected. And so this movie makes you feel nostalgic for an earlier time, both when politicians were held to higher ethical standards, but also when they had more of a right to privacy, perhaps. And Reitman takes this sort of Robert Altman-esque approach. This is very much an ensemble movie, a lot of it shot in long takes. You see behind the scenes of the Hart campaign and also the newsrooms of the Post and the Herald. A lot of good performances here. Hugh Jackman is very good as Hart. Vera Farmiga, even better as his wife, Lee Hart, from whom he is separated at the time of the movie. And as Donna Rice, the woman who was dragged into the spotlight, Sarah Paxton gives a very sharp and sympathetic performance. The movie tries to treat her and everyone with kind of an equal measure of compassion, but also critical scrutiny. The trouble is, I think all this even-handedness, it kind of just results in a sort of mealy-mouthed, dramatic inertia almost. It's interesting to be reminded of this time in history, but watching it play out just wasn't as compelling as I wanted it to be.
The Front Runner, the Gary Hart story, again starring Hugh Jackman, Vera Farmiga, Alfred Molina, and J.K. Simmons, from director Jason Reitman. Having spent a fair amount of time talking with Gary Hart about this episode in his life, I'll be very interested in seeing the film and how it's portrayed,
yes,
since I had the chance to talk with him about it. Hmm. The Front Runner is the film. It's rated R. You can see it at the Landmark in West Los Angeles. It'll go wide coming up in a couple more weeks. And Foreign Land, an Israeli documentary directed by Shlomi Eldar. Real briefly, Leo, your thoughts on this?
Yes. So it tracks Shlomi Eldar and an Israeli, Arab-Israeli actor, Ghassan Abbas, who basically relate their stories of how they end up feeling sort of left out in their own homeland. One of them ends up moving to the U.S. to get away from the conflict at home. The other moves away from Tel Aviv to get to a quieter place. Both of them feel completely out of water in their own homeland. And it's quite poignant. There's a moment when Abbas is talking about how Israel is not a political concept. It's something that one should feel inside. It doesn't really matter whether you're an Arab or an Israeli. It's what your country is to you. It's a feeling. And that to have been sort of deprived of that feeling for so long and to see his country torn apart by strife and violence is just heartbreaking. And it's quite potent, powerful, and affecting.
Foreign Land, the documentary, is at Lemley's Town Center in Encino. It's unrated. And I did want to talk about the end of the Los Angeles Film Festival, one of our two major festivals, AFI Fest being the other major one that attempts to be comprehensive. Justin, your thoughts on the end of this era?
It's very sad news, and I wrote a piece in the Times about some of my very fond memories of the LA Film Festival, which I first started covering in 2005. It's after 18 years. You know, it was founded as the Los Angeles Independent Film Festival in 1995, and then I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Leo, Film Independent came in around like 2001 and took it over
and christened
it the Los Angeles Film Festival. And you know, there are a lot of, you know, in the course, the sort of, when you're doing a post-mortem on a festival, which is a very sad and horrible thing to do, you know, a lot of people have cited various reasons, such as the fact that it kept changing locations. You know, for many years it was in Westwood until 2010 when they moved downtown Regal Cinemas, the LA Live, and then recently relocated to ArcLight Culver City. But that's one, you know, that perhaps kept it from finding, you know, an audience base, the identity that it wanted, even though for many years the programming was excellent. So
yeah, it is a sad time, sad to see it go.
So they said they're going to look at other ways of bringing films, you know, right, maybe doing year round events,
dispersing some of those filmmaker focused events throughout the year, which is, I think, is a very good thing and a heartening thing.
All right, again, the end of the Los Angeles Film Festival as a contained festival. Of course, there's still AFI Fest, an annual event here in Los Angeles as well. For our critics, Lael and Justin, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us every week for Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. And if you miss any portion of the program, you just got to hear that review of the movie you're interested. We remind you, it's available 24/7 at kpcc.org/filmweek. You can hear the program. Also, listen to the podcast wherever you get your favorite programs. From all of us, have a terrific weekend.